Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
TV party tonight! TV party tonight!
Oh, we got nothing better to do than watch TV and have a couple of brews.
Don't
want to
talk about anything else.
We don't
want to
know.
We're dedicated, yes,
to our favorite shows.
Oh, my circuit.
Everybody loves Hypnotoad.
Scary Dog.
Blurson at Blurnsville.
Futurama.
Good evening. You are listening to a Rattlegion Broadcasting premiere podcast TV party tonight. I'm your host, the Mandated Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattlegion. Tonight, our favorite show is Lost in Space, brought to you by the good people at Netflix, Legendary Television, Sazama, Shopless Productions, Applebox Entertainment, Synthesis Entertainment, and Clickety Clack Productions. Joining me on this 24th mission... this 8-year journey, this 3-hour tour, that was a different show. Ladies and gentlemen, everyone's favorite science fiction fan, David Wright. How do you do, sir?
I'm doing good, Mark. Yourself?
I'm doing just fine. Yeah, it's going to be one of those shows. I'm going to try not to cough all the way through it. I'm going to do my best.
That'd be good.
So, explain something to me.
Okay.
You're a smart man. You watched both season one and season two, obviously.
Okay.
I thought at the end of season two, our heralded crew got kidnapped by the alien robots. And that was the last we saw of them. Because when this one opens up, they're stranded on a tiny strip of beach land, and there's no robots to be found. I am confused.
Right. Okay, so they had the good robot, you know, the one that was there for all of the season,
yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah. And then there was the other robot from the other ship that came at the end.
Mm-hmm.
That they have called Sar now, I think the second alien robot.
Sure.
And they had a big fight, and then they kicked them both out of the Jupiter 2, and then they flew into the Resolute where they continued to fight. So all robots are off the Jupiter 2 now.
Uh-huh.
But they left like their alien robot like hyperdrive thingy on the Jupiter 2, which then like merged into the Jupiter 2 and basically hyper-jumped it to some other place in space where they were lost in it.
were they more loster in space?
Yes.
Okay, so they were not then kidnapped by the alien race of robots.
No, they just had some sort of alien hyperdrive thingy that they didn't know how to work that just sent them to a different place.
Okay. Well, that's where we find our intrepid crew. We've got our family who has been trying to make a go of it on this tiny strip of land. They've got a garden growing. They're doing the Martian routine, you know, the movie with Matt Damon. They're growing vegetables, and they're trying to make a life for themselves on this planet where the atmosphere is ammonia or something.
Yeah, it kills you if you breathe in too much of it.
Yeah, that's feeling what I'm going through right now. Parker Posey, our good old Dr. Smith, is trapped in a room, and occasionally they turn the light on, and she says, "Hey, I'll be good if you let me out," and they say, "Piss off, you." They figure out eventually how to get off the planet, and Smith manages to manipulate herself out of the cell and manipulate the situation further, creating an incident that forces them to get off the damn planet, and that's kind of our first arc here. So now that we've established how we got from here to there, we talked about the first season when we did the first TV party tonight on this. What were your expectations going into season two?
Well, I was expecting a lot more of just the Robinsons and Dr. Smith plus Don West out on their own with just this sort of buggy hyperdrive on their ship that would just kind of keep on jumping them around, you know, the galaxy, you know, to sort of facilitate their different adventures. I, you know, wasn't expecting to see them sort of join up again with the other colonists and have more drama that way. So I called that one completely wrong. But it's fine, because still what they did was good. It's usually been the Robinsons by themselves plus Don West and Dr. Smith in some form for the previous two incarnations of this franchise. So the addition of having them being part of a larger colonist group that they keep on meeting up and separating with is, you know, it's a new way of going about it, which I think works in many ways, though it doesn't make them seem quite as lost in space as they used to be.
Yeah, and I don't know if I hate that idea.
Yeah, I don't hate it. It's just different.
Yeah, for a show called Lost in Space, it's got a very Martian vibe to it. You know, we talked about the Martian in a previous podcast, where basically we have a stranded astronaut who has to figure out how to survive by himself with no food or water on Mars for an extended period of time before he can be retrieved and taken back home. He has no way of getting off Mars. And so it becomes very traditional science fiction. There's a problem. You have to figure it out with, you know, math and science and, you know, and that's where the drama and the tension is. And I'll be honest with you, this is where my nerdiness precedes my geekiness, exceeds my geekiness. Because I really like the idea of... This is why I like mystery detective type stuff. I also like traditional, non-fantasy-based science fiction where there's a problem. The problem is the plot. And then they have to actually use some degree of real science, or at least science as it's established in whatever made up world they're in, to figure it out.
Yeah, and that's
then that's very much what this show is. So it isn't Monster of the Week or, you know, I would say in terms of different science fiction structures and girders, this isn't Star Trek The Next Generation. Where it's every week they went from place to place, or Voyager or something like that. Where every week they went from place to place and they had, you know, there was a kind of a Monster of the Week vibe from the thing that they encountered from episode to episode. And that's a very deconstructionist view of Star Trek The Next Generation. Or even the traditional Star Trek. This, and I can't even think of like another example of this. I have more. I keep thinking of some of the more detective shows that I watch where each week they have to use their skill set to solve whatever the mystery is. But that's really the structure of this show, which is not the structure of the 60s show. The 60s show was more like was more Star Trek-y in nature, if I recall.
Well, it was kind of like sitcom meets kind of Star Trek-y, because they didn't really travel that much between planets. It was always the same planet. Or that was kind of like their homestead. Mm-hmm. And it was just sort of whatever props Irwin Allen could get his hands on for cheap to write some sort of story around that would last for an hour. Mm-hmm. That show is pretty dated, and it's pretty obvious how low budget it was. But it's like, I think I mentioned this last time. I remember I saw like an episode of Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, another show produced by Irwin Allen at the time, where they were having to deal with some sort of, you know, like sea monster, and it basically looked like the old Gorn costume from TOS Star Trek, right? Just obviously a man in a suit just walking around, you know, grr, grr. And then in this episode of Lost in Space, they were like, oh, there's an alien monster after us, and it's the exact same man in the suit. You know, it's like, you know, say what you will about Irwin Allen, the man knew how to, you know, stretch a budget. He may be a little too far. But
the CBS show that he's just walking around, you know, different film lots going, hey, what is lying around here that I could use?
Yeah, and then you would have John and Don being the sort of, you know, like the manly, we got to go out and, you know, protect the family, you know, make sure all the women get inside the ship. And then the robot, Dr. Smith and Will, formed like a comedy group that would be, you know, fooling around somewhere else or getting into trouble. But, you know, like it was what it was for its time period. It was, I think the concept of Lost in Space was probably better than the actual show itself.
All right, so then I have it wrong then. This is closer to the way the series ran than I'm remembering, because I thought Lost in Space was they were literally going, you know, they were traveling somewhere. I'm guessing the Jupiter 2 for a large stretch of the show was grounded.
Yeah, it was. Again, I think mostly because they had no money.
Okay. Well, now that we got that established. So the first season, just to bridge everything, finish bridging, and then we can move forward. They crash land on this planet, and then it's a matter of first getting out of the very first problem that they're in. They meet the robot in the same episode, and then it's moving from that to there's a lot of establishing of characters. They have to establish Don West. There's a lot of background on June Harris / Dr. Smith and where she's from and why she's doing the nefarious things she's doing. Then they establish that other colonists have also landed on this world, and then it's a matter of getting off the goddamn planet and getting back to the Resolute. And that's pretty much the whole season, and then you have the finale with the other robot and what have you. This one, it's a few different arcs. The first arc is them getting off the new planet that they're stranded on. And you have the sort of conflict between Dad Robinson and Maureen, who are, you know, Maureen's kind of figured out a way to get off, but the father's like, hey, look, we're finally safe and settled, and, you know, I don't want to push it, and then something happens and we all die.
Yeah, the family's getting along well together. He doesn't want to risk things falling apart.
So he's not so much willing to go. But then, as I said before, Dr. Smith weasels her way out of her cell. She starts manipulating Penny, I think it is. And she creates a situation where they have to go. And she later on, she'll admit that to Maureen. She was like, we both know. And this is, I'll tell you what, Parker Posey is my favorite actress on this show. She's incredible.
Oh, she gives a very good performance. Her acting is, you know, very solid.
Yeah, she nails this character, and it's probably the most interesting character on the whole thing, in my opinion.
Well, Dr. Smith is probably the hardest character to do right, because, you know, the idea of, like, this is the person who's responsible for the problem that they're in. They're kind of the bad guy. Yet having a reason why they don't just strand them on a planet or throw them out an airlock to save themselves is kind of the issue. In the original, they ended up making Dr. Smith kind of like a, basically kind of like a boob. Like, not necessarily evil, but just kind of lazy and incompetent. You know, so he could make trouble, but not to the point of anyone wanting to kill him. Whereas in the movie, which you'll get into, I'm sure. Yeah, it's basically like, seriously, why do they not just kill the Gary Oldman, Dr. Smith? Because it's only a matter of time before he kills them all.
I was going to say, well, they certainly threatened you enough times. But in the comic book that we reviewed on Monday, I kind of compared the Dr. Smith in the Lost in Space comic, and I don't know if he was like this on the show, to kind of like Gorgeous George from the old professional wrestling. Just kind of a fop and, you know, like, don't touch me, you know, and just very pompous and arrogant.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So, these first two episodes, I'm going to pitch it over to you here. The first two episodes deal with the problem of getting to the point where everyone agrees they should get off the world, then how are they going to do it, then actually doing it. The other thing that they're dealing with is they've got this engine, they don't know how to make it work. And of course, they don't know where the robot is, and this is Will's primary issue. So, let me pitch it over to you. These first two episodes, what did you think?
Overall, good start. It sort of gets us up to speed with where everyone's at right now, and like how the relationships in the family have shifted. You know, like they've seemed to come together a lot more, and you know have managed to become a family again, which I thought was good. And then yeah, we get back more into the sciencey thing of how do we survive. And you have, on the one hand, John saying, I like things the way they are. The kids are happy. Our family's together. Nothing is immediately trying to kill us that we're aware of. This is good. Whereas, Maureen's kind of going like, if we just stay here the rest of our lives, the kids are never going to meet anyone else. They're just going to grow up lonely, and that's just not much of a life for them. And then Smith, again, using the situation more to her advantage. Which I thought was interesting, the whole idea of, I've been in jail a few times. Like, you think if I don't know how to escape a cell, you're wrong. So, what's the point in locking me up? I'm just going to escape. May as well just keep me out in the open where you can at least keep your eyes on me more.
Well, it's also very true. Any inmate will tell you, and Lord knows I have enough experience with those folks, that they have nothing to do but sit and think and figure things out. And they are very observant, because what else is there to look at? So they watch people, and they see, and the more savvier ones will see how people behave, and then we'll start hatching, a plot to figure out how to get them to do what they need them to do.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was a nice twist for Smith. And then you get more into the Martian / Apollo 13 storyline of, okay, we have a problem, now we need to use science and engineering, math, all that good stuff to figure out a solution, which ends up with them taking all the parts needed to turn the ship into a sailing ship, which they just happen to have lying around. I love the design of the Jupiter 2, or the Jupiter ships. They're really, you can really tell that they put a lot of effort into sort of the layout of the ships and the utility of them while still making them kind of comfortable for a hero ship. But holy smokes, the cargo capacity on that thing is got to be close to a TARDIS at this point.
Yes, it's got a magic bag of holding in the docking bay.
Pretty much. And they still were able to use that to kind of flush out some of the relationships, Penny's arc, which kind of doesn't get quite addressed in this, is her sort of feeling a bit inadequate compared to everyone else in terms of her ability to science stuff.
I was going to say, that was a major thread throughout this thing. What do you mean by it doesn't get addressed at this point?
I wouldn't say addressed, but I didn't really see there was an end to it, whereas the other sort of arcs for the characters, maybe with the exception of Smith, though we'll feel that out a bit more later in the show, kind of were addressed. Will kind of develops with his relationship with the robot and that sort of thing. Judy comes into her own as understanding she's a person, and John and Maureen sort of start to let
Lucky Land Casino asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess.
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Let their kids go. Depend on each other more, that kind of stuff.
I don't know. I thought as the season two developed, I thought of anybody, Penny got... Okay, let's break it down.
Okay.
So I think Judy... There's two things going on with Judy, and I kind of like this. She got taken down a peg, in the sense of... She was very like hoity, and you know, I don't know, almost like I'm an adult. You know, it's like I understand she's 19 in the show, or you know, 18 or 19 somewhere in there when the show starts.
And we've all been there. Like when you're like in your late teens or a young adult, you know, you think you've got the world figured out, and you know exactly what's going on and what's going to happen to you.
She's almost like
and turns out we were all wrong.
Yeah, no kidding. She almost comes across as like precocious, and I know that's a word often associated with younger children, but she definitely is a bit obnoxious, and I kind of like that throughout. There's in the next arc that they go through of a couple of episodes, there's a bit where she's like, okay, well, you know, they've returned to the fleet, they've returned to the Resolute, because of, and this is actually the next question I got to ask you, but there was a situation created with the alien robots where they had to abandon the Resolute for a little bit. So everyone's down on the planet below, and they're mining for water. And she goes back to the medical personnel, and they're like, yeah, you're a first year. You're an intern. Go stock shit.
Yeah.
She's like, yeah. But I'm a doctor. Like, uh-huh. Very nice. Now go, so is everybody else here. Go stock things. The problem with that was they did it once, and then her dad falls in the well, and he gets run through, and there's this and the episode itself is really great because she goes running to him, and you get a lot of flashback about their relationship and her frustrations with him having left the family after, you know, they had formed this really close bond, and her unwillingness to forgive him until he nearly dies, and then she kind of gets over it. And so I liked all of that, but then they never address that again.
Yeah. Well, it also kind of establishes that she sort of has that type A personality of, you know, she's always top of the class, you know, wins all the awards, like, things tend to come quite easy to her. She has that sort of discipline to achieve, and when you couple that in the first season, her failing for the first time where, you know, her patient dies and she's unable to save him and just sort of having to face up with that, you know, like this time I wasn't able to do it. Maybe I'm not as good as I think I am. You know, she has to, you know, learn a bit of humility there, and then she gets slapped in the head again with that when she rejoins with the rest of the colonist groups, like you said.
I just wish they had done more with it, that they introduce it and never really gets a resolution. I mean, I think internally with the character, there's a bit of an evolution, but I don't know. I wish there had been a little bit more of her having to be kept down a peg.
Because once she rescues her dad and she gets back to the medical barracks, you know, it's almost like this attitude of like, "See, told you I was you know better than this."
Yeah,
I mean, she doesn't say it or anything, but you know, it's kind of framed a bit in that way of like, okay, yeah, she actually is a doctor.
Yeah, and then they never go back to it. They're too busy doing other stuff.
Yeah.
So, and then you have Penny, who, and I actually thought she had the best kind of internal personal story of feeling like she doesn't have a role in the family. Like she's almost comedy relief. You know, she's not Will, she's not Judy, she's not Mom, she's not Dad. They all have very defined roles, and she's
Dr. Smith likes her.
Of course, well, she's the easiest to manipulate. She's kind of Meg in Family Guy. She's like, and then there's Meg.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that she, early on in the first two episodes, she actually deals with that with her mother, and how it's like, I'm the least good Robinson, and... But then they give her a lot this season. There's that whole thing with the rust virus thing that's affecting all the metal. She has a big role to play in that. They give her, you know, that leads to the bit where she has to, you know, get into the container out in space for a few minutes. They kind of hinted at a relationship with her and Don. Like they there's a few droplets, a few nuggets.
Yeah. So canonically, it's usually Judy and Dawn that hook up.
Mm-hmm. But they definitely kind of hinted at some of that here. Nothing direct. She's still a child, but It definitely feels like her and Don kind of got closer in this season.
Yeah, well, I'd say that personality-wise, they're probably the closest together. They both kind of have that sarcasm, sort of sharp wit to them.
But I would say even as things moved on later in the season, they were still dealing with Penny and her feelings of, like, how do I fit into this family?
Yeah, that's kind of what I meant. It's just, like, I never really found that there was, like, that sort of moment of, aha, this is who I am, this is how I fit in, this is what I have to contribute.
Okay.
But, yeah, I mean, she wasn't just, like, a bystander doing nothing for the whole season.
They gave her a ton.
Yeah, yeah. But where it's more like, you know, with Judy at the end where you have, like, her, you know, like her parents saying, like, no, like, you know, you're an adult now. We trust you. You've got the stuff. You can captain a ship now. You've got to, you know, be the adult for all these kids. You know, that was sort of her payoff. With Will, it was him acknowledging that, you know, I'm growing up, I'm changing, and so is the robot. And having this relationship where it's all one way is not healthy. That's not what friends do. You know, and that was sort of his big payoff at the end there. John and Maureen were more or less, you know, like, we're good and we're still good.
Yeah.
And even sort of Dr. Smith kind of had the whole, like, oh, man, like, me being a manipulative psychopath kind of really makes it that when there's a problem, nobody really cares about me. You know, like, these people that had me imprisoned in their ship for the last 7 months are kind of like the closest thing I've got to, you know, people who care about me. So, you know, now it's time for me to step up and help them. Yeah, so, like they're, you know, each kind of those characters kind of have that moment, and I just felt there wasn't really quite one for Penny.
Yeah. So this next middle arc of the show, and it's only 10 episodes. The first two, like I said, deal with them getting off the planet again, and then there's this large swath of episodes right in the middle where I guess you can kind of subdivide these. There's the introduction of Scarecrow and the rejoining of the Resolute. There's the introduction of the problem, which is getting the colonists off the planet, back onto the Resolute, and they can't because of the rust issue. There's this techno-organic virus that's causing the metal to just disintegrate.
Yeah, it's like a microorganism that eats metal.
Yeah.
Which is bad when most of the things you have are made out of metal, like spaceships.
So there's all of that. And that introduces a bigger issue, which is, if this had to be summed up in an overall arc, it's they discovered a signal with it, which they assume is Alpha Centauri. So it's a matter of getting enough water to make enough air to get everybody back on the Resolute and make the trip from where they are to wherever Alpha Centauri is from where they are. They need to get one of the robots, either Will's robot or Scarecrow, to operate the engine, or none of this is going to work. And then, as I mentioned, they need enough water to make breathable air.
Yep.
And that's kind of the weight and breadth of most of this season. There's different things that pop up, like I said. So let's break this down. Let's talk about the introduction of Scarecrow and what he represents to the season, and what did you think of his introduction? And we have our villain as of sorts that gets introduced, which is Hastings, which we can also talk about. And then I'm trying to figure out what the character's name is.
So Ashcroft or something like that? Started with A, I know that much.
Yeah, I'm trying to find his name here.
IMDb race.
Adler.
Adler. I was close, but yeah.
So let's talk about Scarecrow. What did you think of the Adler-Scarecrow relationship and how they affected the plot?
Yeah, well, I wasn't too surprised that they already had alien technology on the Resolute, because it was pretty obvious, since I've seen, like, a TV show before, it wasn't an asteroid that was the Christmas star. It was, an alien spaceship. And that they were using the hyperdrive, for lack of a better term, to power the Resolute for the colonists. So, yeah, like, I didn't realize that there was a robot there as well, that they had basically lobotomized into working as the navigation system for it. But yeah, it was an interesting moral dilemma that they used with the Scarecrow and the whole treating of the robots. Because there is that sort of, I think I mentioned it before, the sort of butcher's arithmetic that you sort of have to do in like tough situations like this in terms of like survival, or especially in war, where it's like, you know, these are the things we can do. Let's try and figure out the option that involves with the less of our people getting killed. Mm-hmm. And but even then, that option still involves people getting killed. So you kind of have to be a cold, calculating son of a gun in order to do that.
All right, so we had Bizarro Robot and Superman Robot fighting at the end of Season 1. And they're shown in Season 2 cascading into the Resolute.
Yeah.
This is the action that causes everyone to abandon the Resolute and go down to the planet, correct?
Yep.
Okay. And then I guess they eventually got off the Resolute and landed on the planet themselves, at which point the bad robot threw the good robot in a pit and set up a trap for Will.
Yes.
Okay.
Pretty much. That, yeah.
And what did the bad robot want from Will?
We're not really sure on that yet. That's I think that's one of those sort of future mysteries yet to be revealed.
Okay.
In a future season, because it seems like the robots do have some sort of relationship with Will, like the King robot, like at the end, for lack of a better term, you know, like it you know, it knew his name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you're Will Robinson, and he was like, you know, we don't have to fight, we could be friends, and then the robot just thought for a second, then, you know, nah. and the action resumed.
Right.
But so yeah, we're not really sure what it is about Will that sort of allows him to get along better with some of the robots.
It's his innocence. The innocence of a child, David.
Maybe. But it is interesting to kind of have that comparison between him and Adler, where, you know, Adler wanted the relationship with Scarecrow that Will had with the robot, but was not really able to get it, so he just took to, you know, electroshock therapy, basically, to at least get
be my friend or be tortured.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit different, because in Will's case, it was, you know, well, we're both on this tree, and we're gonna die, so, you know, may as well kick you off so you can potentially survive, because, you know, one person dying is better than two people dying, and then that kind of got the robot to adopt Will as a friend or master in that situation, whereas, you know, Adler is, he's, you know, found this robot, you know, in this crashed ship, so people are kind of a bit upset about the whole, you crashed your ship into our planet, and now our planet's dying thing, and just also, you know, we're on a clock, we need to get results, you know, we can't spend, you know, 30 years for you in the hopes that, you know, this robot will one day be your friend. You know, you need to get a solution here, or we'll find someone else who will. Like, yeah, that was probably the situation that he was in.
Mm.
So, like, it was a good way that they sort of set up in Adler that sort of dichotomy of, you know, him wanting to not torture the robots, but also kind of having to. So I think that was an interesting thing. And then, of course, in the end, you have him, you know, in the end decide that, you know, I'm, you know, I've done bad, and I need to make things right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, him basically sacrificing his life for Scarecrow in the end, and, you know, like his last words, you know, like, if, you know, if we were able to do this again, let's, you know, let's do it better, or be friends, or something like that.
So they deal with that, and then we have the two-part episode where they're dealing with the I'm going to just keep calling it the Rust. Where they're dealing with the Rust, which then leads to the last four episodes, 7, 8, 9, and 10, which is they are, you know, they're talking about the length of time it's going to take to decontaminate the water and whether or not they've got enough ammonia, et cetera, et cetera. And then, like everything else in this show, they realize they are out of time. And I'm just going to read this. Captain Kamal suddenly seems alarmed by an audio transmission that ends the conversation that she's having. The transmission will reveal that numerous alien ships are converging on the Resolute. So the robots are coming.
Yep, and they never arrive.
No, that was the most confusing thing about the show, is that I thought I was seeing the robots, like I thought they were there at the end of Season 1, and then they don't seem to be there anymore. And then there's a whole, you know, skipping ahead for a minute.
Yeah, I think it was just one ship at the end of Season 1.
Okay. Which maybe it went back to the, you know, to the mothership and said, hey, this way.
they
cut the engine.
Yeah, and they also kind of mentioned that this system that they're in now is closer to the robot's home system.
Mm-hmm.
So there stands to reason there'd be more ships in that area.
Later on, there's a bit where basically Good Robot says, for better or for worse, we must heal my friend. We're not, you know, we must heal this other robot. I will not let him die. I cannot let him die. And so, despite the fact that they don't have a good relationship with this robot, and it seems likely to kill them all, Will insists that if we're gonna, you know, if you want to use my robot for anything, the robot also says I'm not helping until we do this. They end up going down to the planet to back down to the planet to get the second robot healed, which it does, but apparently it woke up a hive of robot who were like, fuck, the engine's up there. And of course they all attack, and this I think they're coming up, and there's other ships coming along the way, and it's just they're about to the Resolute is about to be overrun with giant alien robots. So they want to hightail it out of there before any of this happens, which means leaving a lot of the colonists behind, which then forces Maureen into a situation where she mutinies.
Yep.
And they're going to take the Resolute down to a gas giant to where they can capture enough ammonia to decontaminate enough of the water to get everybody on board and off to Alpha Centauri. And they are trying to do this in the ta-da nick of time. So this arc, the robots are coming, Maureen's mutiny, and the saving of the second robot. Let's, you know, which one you want to tackle first?
I guess let's start with the mutiny. Yeah, so again, back to the whole Butcher's arithmetic thing is, you know, like, you can see that there with the captain's reasoning is,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's just like the odds of us getting the water cleaned in time versus, you know, getting out of here safely, you know, and get repaired is, you know, like, the safer option is to abandon the colonists for now. I mean, to be in her defense, she was going to go back and pick them up.
Right. That's the thing.
Kamala, like, she's not being a jerk. She just had to make a really jerk decision.
Sure. And that's what I was going to say. You know, Kamala and Hastings, for lack of a better phrase, are kind of your villains of this season. And Hastings more than Kamala. I think Kamala is
we'll get to him
situation.
In a minute. Yeah. But and also, like, Maureen's a scientist, whereas Kamala is probably more of a military person. So, you know, like, she doesn't really, you know, she's doesn't have that way of thinking that Maureen has, as to like, oh, I can just, you know, do the math and work out, yes, this will definitely work. She's more like, you know, what are the risks? You know, what's the you know, best course of action
right.
here?
The greater good is what she's motivated
yeah,
by.
Yeah, the greater good. Yeah, and we do see that, you know, when Maureen succeeds, she sort of has that pivoting moment of like, oh, okay, you know, like, she's right, you know, the math says it's possible. So, you know, she sort of gets her redemption in that way.
Right, and we don't even really see her undone by an earlier decision to get Will to Alpha Centauri because Hastings uses her codes that she gave him in trade against her. And, you know, I think we need to talk about Hastings now because... I don't see Hastings as, like, a totally, like, malevolent character. I think he's definitely one of these villains who I think is shaped by... This is the way I feel about this. This is what I think. I think I'm right.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do what I need to do to carry out what I think is best for everybody else involved here.
Yeah, there's that element to it. But, like you know, there's a saying, you know, the best villains are the heroes of their own story. Well, Hastings wants to be the hero of his own story.
Yes.
Like, when he's talking to Adler and Adler's having second thoughts about torturing robots, he's like, you know, oh, but, you know... You know, history will remember us as great heroes, whereas if we, you know, if we mess up just once, we'll be, you know, remembered as screw ups. And, you know, it's kind of like a man who is in love with the idea of his own legend. And that's sort of where he sort of crosses the line into being a bit more of a villain. Whereas, mm-hmm. you know, like, Kamala, she's, you know, she's just doing her job. She's like, you know, I got to get this ship to Alpha Centauri in one piece with the least number of people dying.
You know, it's funny. We talk. I talk to people all the time who, are like, oh, I don't want to fly in an airplane. Airplanes crash. I'm like, hundreds of flights, thousands of flights take place per day.
Yeah.
All the time, all over the world. You only hear about the crash if it happens.
Yeah, yeah. It's as with most things, you know, most things are perfectly fine, but, you know, you only hear about it when things go horribly wrong, and thanks to the internet echo chamber effect, you know, now people think that that's the norm rather than the exception.
Right.
Right.
So, you know, so when he's talking about how, you know, I think it's like something like 20-some-odd flights to Alpha Centauri have gone off without a hitch.
Yeah, this FYI, you're like thousands of times more likely to die in your car to and from the airport than on an airplane.
Yeah.
Like my dad and I, we used to go flying together, and we'd always joke, like, after the flight was done, like in a small aircraft, we'd, you know, get in the car in the parking lot. It's like, right, now the dangerous part.
So the line is something along the lines of 20-some-odd flights to Alpha Centauri, not a single problem. This has been the only disaster.
Yeah.
You know, this is the one. This is the one everyone will talk about. This is the one everyone will remember, and we're the ones in charge of it.
Yeah, so that was kind of like the more where it's his sort of ego or hubris interfering with things, as opposed to just, you know, let's get the job done, let's save the human race sort of thing.
I think it's also, you know, self-preservation. I mean, if you're in charge of a mission that's gone completely foobar, someone's going to have words with you.
Yeah, and also, like, what's the head of security doing illegally getting, like, everyone's access codes to the ship system? I mean, definitely handy thing to have, but it's also still illegal.
Yeah.
Like there's probably a reason why one person doesn't have all these codes at their disposal.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if they knew they were going to get a second season, and that's what... Because you didn't know what she traded.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was kind of happy that we took care of that one now. Like, oh, okay, good, don't have to worry about that anymore.
Let's talk a bit about the mutiny, which is, I think, where we started, but we had to establish the villains first.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those where, you can see the villain's point of view. It's like, well, we're not abandoning them. We got to go, and we'll come back later. It'll be fine. They can figure this out. And Maureen's like, no, everyone. It's like, on the one hand, it's a very heroic thing. It's just incredibly short-sighted and, you know, and almost stupid dangerous.
Yeah. Well, I remember there's a book I read. It was called Jar Jar Binks Must Die and Other Related Essays on Science Fiction Films. Quite an entertaining book. But one of the things the author went into was sort of talking about how the character of sort of the hero character changed in these movies over time. And he talks about the original thing versus the remake of The Thing, like the John Carpenter original movie. Because in the original Thing, like, the hero was like the military guy who was like, you know, oh, you know, we need to contain this, we need to, you know, not make any rash decisions, you know, establish what's going on in this situation and move forward. And then, like, the idiot that got almost everyone killed was the, you know, bleeding heart scientist, like, oh, this is our first, you know, exposure to extraterrestrial life, and we need to communicate with it and be friends, and, you know, we shouldn't put any restrictions on it, and he's the one that lets it out, so it starts killing people. and you know, then you get into, like, you know, the remake, where it's like, you know, the military guy is the person who's going to get everyone killed, because, like, we got to kill this thing, it's not American, you know, so on and so forth. And then, you know, like, the hero is like the scientist, oh, we need to understand it and be friends with it, sort of thing. And it's just sort of, yeah, it's interesting how that sort of has changed in media, probably the farther we've gone away from, like, the Second World War, where, you know, it was that type of person that, you know, you need the one who will make the hard decisions, you know, as opposed to now it's like, well, let's just, you know, everyone should be happy, sort of thinking.
So we get to the finale here. Everything leads to a head. They're trying to get the hell, you know, out of that system before the aliens kill them all. And I think, you know, they as far as, like, cleaning the oxygen and all of that, they've just run out of time. There's nothing more they can do. And then Judy, of course, finds out that her mother made the trade that got Will onto the ship in the first place. So, you know, Judy kind of throws it back in Maureen's face, like, look, we have just enough air and just enough space for only the children. And she wasn't even intending to go with them, but they were like, well, somebody's got to be in charge of this fuck ship. So, yeah. So you're it. But they're like, look, someone has to go to Alpha Centauri, and the rest of you need to run like hell somewhere else. They've only got one warp drive. So, this leads to a very tearful, like, this broke my heart, this scene.
Yeah.
It was punctuated by impending death as the robots are converging on this one Jupiter, you know, and there's a big action fight scene, you know, in a show that doesn't have a tremendous amount of action in it. I think they did a really good job of making the finale of season two kind of action-packed and very, you know, tense and adventurous, and a lot of, you know, they had a lot of stuff going on here to, and I would say the whole season, really, there was a lot of it where the first, like, I binged the first five during the second half of the Super Bowl, and then until I went to bed, until I finished the first five episodes, and part of it was I wanted to see what was going to happen next. Like, there was a couple of really good cliffhangers right at the beginning to hook you, whereas the first season, I was like, I pushed because you wanted to watch it, and it got better over time. But I would say there was no lull this season. There was, like, almost through the whole thing, I wanted to know what was going to happen next, and I was really into what the story they were telling. So they had established earlier in the season that Judy's dad was on a ship called the Fortuna, and he was presumed dead in all of this. And I had mentioned before there was a signal, which they assumed was coming from Alpha Centauri. So the alien robots converge on the one Jupiter that's got all the kids on it, but they are rescued. They are saved by Scarecrow, who is back to life and ready to fight. So they are able to take off. Maureen and John Robinson.
Yep.
Take off in their own Jupiter. Everybody scatters. The Resolute goes all Enterprise, goes tits up, and and they are able to blow away the aliens by doing this, and the kids take off for Alpha Centauri. But they discover that they have not gone to Alpha Centauri. They have gone to someplace else. They do not know where. And lo and behold, what do they see in the distance but Judy's father's ship, the long lost Fortuna. And presumably we're going to get a season three. So, closing out our discussion here, what did you think of this final episode, 97?
Not bad. I was sort of thinking, I was thinking more that the answer would be, like, make peace with the robots. Like, that was sort of what they were going with Will, but turns out that didn't happen.
Well, the robots were a tad unreasonable.
Yeah.
They were not asking politely for their engine back. They were killing everyone that got in their way.
Yeah, like, I almost sort of thought, like, you know, if you just probably, you know, kicked the engine out of an airlock or something, they'd probably just go grab it and then just be on their way.
Well,
like,
here's the problem. Then they really are lost. They're just going to live on the Resolute or they all die. They can't go anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, they've got enough people to build a colony, I would say. I mean, again, not the most ideal option, but I would say trying to survive on an alien planet with a bunch of supplies for surviving on an alien planet with a population large enough to sustain itself is better than being ripped apart by alien robots.
I think the established Alpha Centauri colony was the mission. And I think I don't think anyone was like, well, we just won't make as many cars. That's a gung-ho the movie reference, everybody.
Yeah.
we'll take option B. There is no option B. It's Alpha Centauri or bust.
Yeah, but so that was kind of what I was thinking would happen through most of it, but then, you know, obviously I was wrong. My expectations were subverted. But then they did things with subverting those expectations. That's the important part, guys. You know, as Jay Mobin pointed out, you know, it's easy to subvert expectations. Just go, well, what do you think is going to happen? Well, I think this is going to happen. Okay, well, then we won't do that. Congratulations, you have just subverted expectations.
I don't know what movie you're referencing.
Half in the Bag, Red Letter Media.
I know.
okay,
damn it.
Right. Yeah. Okay, at least I didn't fall into the trap completely there. But yeah, and yeah, it was emotional doing the whole, you know, like, yeah, having to say goodbye to your kids, and then also having the whole, you know, coming of age thing with Judy sort of layered on top of that. I was expecting a bit of that with Will, where I think they're going in that direction with him and Maureen. You're like, you can't protect me forever, Mom. Like, I have to be my own person at some point.
Well, he talked about being brave, you know. He was such a frightened child in the first season and so unsure of himself. And I remember there was flashbacks to him and the dad kind of having that. And God, do I relate to this. Like, I love my son to death, and I think he's going to turn out and be like an awesome guy, an awesome man when he gets older. But there are some times where I'm just like, you know, whereas, look, if you're the kind of dad that I am, you want your son to muscle up. I don't mean necessarily physically, but toughen up, muscle up, you know.
Yeah.
And when they don't at times, and they just go to pieces, as children are wont to do, it is the height of frustration.
Yeah. I mean, you still got some time.
Sure. He's only going to be six. I get it.
You want to teach him that, you know, life doesn't always go according to the plan. There's going to be tough crap you got to deal with. And
right.
I need to teach you how to deal with this, so when I'm not here, you're going to be okay.
Yes, that is the job of the parent. I've talked about this with Sean on, you know, during On Trials and, you know, different movies. Like, I just went back and I listened to our Santa Claus episode. And I always feel like Hollywood writes tough dads as almost villainous. Like, the act of being a tough dad is intrinsically a negative thing in these movies. And I'm like, but it's not. I think this is an important role. Like, I'm thankful that my dad was as hard on me as he was.
Yeah, it's not really anything you appreciate until you get older and you realize, like, oh, that's what they were doing.
Yeah.
Like, oh, thank goodness.
Right. And so the relative point here is that I sometimes feel like the writers went out of their way to make John a heel, when John, I think he's a more well-rounded character than all of that. And so the point being, in the first season, they went out of their way to kind of make John and Will's relationship a bit tenuous, you know, and he was harder on the kid than maybe he needed to be, but it blooms and it bears fruit in the second season, because through having been parented the way that he was by John, and then in developing a relationship with this robot and just sort of living through the trauma of being lost in space.
That's a good title.
Yes, we should write that down.
Yeah.
he does toughen up, and he kind of announces, in case the audience at home hadn't figured it out, hey, I'm not afraid anymore. I can deal with this.
And yeah, I think first season is like John's kind of learning how to, you know, stop being Will's commanding officer and be his father.
Right.
I mean, there's some overlap there, but yeah, it's sort of him kind of getting more in touch with his, you know, touchy-feely father side while it's still, you know, teaching him, you know, like the ways of the world and how to survive in it. Yeah, it's also like there's a I forget what his actual title is, like a professor of, I think, psychology or something. His name's Jonathan Haidt. I think he's at one of the New York campuses, and he talks about this idea of anti-fragility. Sort of the idea, it's basically like, you know, what does not kill you makes you stronger. It's you know, like the more you know, sort of tough situations you are exposed to but get through, then, you know, the next time you're not going to be as afraid of it, because you're like, oh, you know, I've had worse than this, you know, like I'll make it through, and you're able to deal with that situation better than before.
Yes, it's the toughening of leather.
Yeah, it's like the first time I got dumped by a girl, you know, like it was months of putting myself back together. The last time I was dumped, a couple of days, like, yeah, it's kind of sucks, and then I was, you know, back out there, all right, you know, we'll see if, you know, next time we'll do better, and I did.
Very good.
Yeah. So yeah, I think Will's going through the same sort of thing where it's like, I've been almost killed by alien robots so many times now, you know, I'm good.
Boy, you know? Is this all that.
Yeah.
All right, so overall, your thoughts on season two?
Yeah, I think it's better than season one, and season one wasn't that bad. Like you said before, season two really started cooking a lot faster than season one did. And, you know, again, you know, with first seasons, you're always, you know, the writers and the actors are still kind of feeling things out, establishing the characters and their relationships. And season two really benefited from that groundwork. Yet they still were able to give the characters new directions to go in. We haven't really talked about Dr. Smith and sort of her ups and downs through this season, because, I mean, she is the hardest character to get right.
Well, I said at the beginning, I think Parker Posey nails his character. She's the most interesting. Here's the thing. Like, if the original Dr. Smith character was, you know, so always somehow, like, sabotaging whatever was going on with the... with the Smiths, the
yeah,
Robinsons.
It was more sabotage out of ineptitude than malice.
I think she is always trying to set up like a fence around her, to where she is always safe, and she is, you know, I actually talked about, I used the exact same word on the comic book review. She's duplicitous.
Yeah,
and she kind of reads the situation within degrees of it, of nailing it, and figuring out what side of the fence does she need to be at any given time. And I think there are times where she is allied with the Robinsons out of necessity, and she's creating situations in which, but despite themselves, they need her. And then other times where she's selling them out because the situation lended itself to, I need to have a more powerful rabbi in order to be safe.
Yeah, she's always looking out for number one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought the most interesting thing with her in this one was, like, when she realizes that she's killed, like, that little girl's father.
Yeah.
Where, you know, up till now it's like, oh, you know, I know I've hurt people, but they're not people I know or care about, so, you know, what do I care? Others would do the same to me. And now it's like, no, like, this little girl doesn't have a dad anymore because of something I did, like, of a choice I made. Like, now I'm confronted with it, and you see that, you know, she can't even run past her in a hallway to, like, save the universe.
Right.
Or anything. And then the other aspect is she kind of does try to trust someone with John. And then she's, again, because she didn't get to the bridge in time to stop the counter mutiny. You know, like, now John has lost his faith in her, and it's sort of, you know, like, putting her outside of that comfort zone and putting her in a situation where, you know, like, she has to sort of confront the horrible things she's done that she's always been able to justify up to this point. And that sort of culminating with her kind of realizing, you know, like, you know, if I want other people to care about me, I need to care about other people. And yeah, that's going to mean getting hurt sometimes, but it's better than the alternative where I'm stuck alone on the ship that's going to explode and no one's going to give me a ride.
Yes. Speaking of which, it is alluded to, and I assume this is true, that she's on the ship with the kids.
Yeah, that was interesting. Like, I'm very curious to see how they justify her getting out of that, if that is the direction they're going with. Because, yeah, that, I mean, she had an off-screen death, but, you know, like, her helmet did not survive, and she was in space, so, you know, you don't have a lot of time to not die in that situation, like, you know, maybe a couple of minutes tops.
Oh, that's right. She's in the scene where her helmet's cracking, and the room is magnetized or whatever.
Yeah, and the next thing she's surrounded by killer robots.
Yeah, she's surrounded by killer robots, and then somehow or other her helmet goes off in space, and it's assumed she was crushed to death.
Yeah. Well, yeah, her suit would have been crushed by the whatever that it is that they're doing to the robots in that situation. And also having her, you know, helmet crack and then come off is, yeah, I mean, you know, we need oxygen to live, and she's not getting that anymore.
Well, at the very end, the robot notices that in one of the containers is a headband and the ball.
Exactly, and I think she had those with her when she was out, you know, with the robots. So, yeah, I'm curious to see how they do Dr. Smith was able to survive all of that, if she indeed did.
We'll see.
Dun, dun, dun. Yeah.
So, overall, I really enjoyed Season 2 more than Season 1.
Yeah.
Season 1, you know, we've said it before, once it got going, it got good, and by the end of it, I was interested to see what was going to happen next. And then
Go on. Finish your thought.
Season 2 hooked me and then never let go, and now I'm really interested to see what the next chapter is.
Yeah. Remember on our last podcast where we talked about how we're so good at not interrupting each other?
Yeah, you fucked that all up tonight, thanks, Dave.
It's what I do.
I thought Canadians were supposed to be polite, man.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's the most Canadian thing there. Yeah.
You can talk now, David.
Yeah, 1939 to 1945. We apologized our way across Europe. There's no battle cry more feared in the world than "We are so sorry."
Excuse me, pardon me.
Yeah. But anyway, damn, I lost my thought there. It'll come back in just a second here.
Quit fucking around.
Yeah. Oh, right, got it back now. Yeah, I would usually like kind of watch. I made the mistake of trying to watch the show like last thing before bed, just when I'm, you know, relaxing in the evening, and I quickly realized I need to watch this during the daytime, or I'm just going to like marathon 8 episodes in one night.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a slow start for the season for me, but then yeah, kind of by episode 3 or 4, it was just like, you know, yeah, I got to see what happens next. This is really interesting. So yeah, overall, much much stronger. Curious to see where they'll end up in the next season. I really, really hope that Judy and her, like, birth dad don't end up pulling in Ad Astra, because, good lord, that movie was horrible.
I didn't see it.
You did not miss much. You did not miss much at all. Like, I sat in there, the movie started, I waited for something interesting to happen, and then the credits started.
The first season got a 68 approval rating from the critics.
Mm-hmm.
Second season improves by about to 82%. So I think most critics are in line with what we thought, that this definitely got better as time went on.
I thought critics didn't matter anymore.
Ugh.
Yeah. Well, we'll deal with that on the next Damn You Hollywood.
They matter. It's worth talking about.
Yeah, but the only other thing I have to say is, like, the visual effects in this season were just, like, top-notch. Like, there were moments there where I felt like I was watching a movie.
Yeah.
Like,
I don't feel like they spared any expense with this. I don't know what this is costing these various production companies and Netflix to air this thing. You know, and just to have this kind of theoretical exercise... If Netflix doesn't exist, where do you even put this goddamn show?
Yeah, well, this is one of the best aspects of the streaming wars, is a lot of companies seem to be embracing sort of more niche franchises, like, mm-hmm. and like science fiction, but, you know, we're also seeing, you know, fantasy and you know, all sorts of stuff. So it's kind of really nice, because we're getting a lot more of a variety of stuff for everyone. It's not just all lowest common denominator reality shows.
I mean, I guess this might have ended up on HBO. It's made by Legendary.
With more swearing and nudity, but yeah.
Legendary.
But that's more Star Trek now. Oh, yeah.
Legendary is one of the companies that they co-produce and co-finance films with Warner Brothers and Universal. So, you know, maybe this would have ended up on HBO. I can't imagine where in the NBC line of things this would have ended up, if anywhere. I don't know. It's probably good to just where it is.
I think so. Maybe Apple would put it on their streaming service. Amazon Prime has a really great track record of saving excellent science fiction TV shows from disaster.
Mm-hmm. All right, we don't know when season... I mean, I think we got season one... let me see here. So season one came out of April of 2018, and then more than almost a year and a half later, we got season two. So I would imagine we're not going to get season three for at least another year, maybe a little bit longer.
Yeah, I'd say 1 or 2 years would be about reasonable.
Considering the amount of work they have to put into with special effects and whatnot.
Yeah, post on this has got to be pretty major.
So we'll figure it's probably sometime in early 2021, maybe like January or February is my guess.
Yeah, it sounds possible.
All right, what do you got going on in your world? I know you don't do Twitter, so what do you want to plug?
Yep, and I am so much happier for it, I think.
You're missing out on the party.
Yeah. Facebook's enough of a party for me, thanks. Yeah. Yeah, no Twitter, no Instagram. I'm being an old man early. I'm the next Johnny Lawrence.
Let's see. When do we have you back on again?
Birds of Prey, I think we'll be going to see that this weekend.
Okay, so are you jumping on the Damn You Hollywood is what you're trying to tell me?
Yeah, unless I see it and have nothing to say, then I'll probably skip it, because what's the point? But
okay. So maybe David Wright on Birds of Prey, maybe not.
Yeah, that's what happened with Endgame, was like, I watched it, like, that was good, but I can't really think of anything strong to say about it, so, you know, what's the point?
Well, here's the next couple of movies and TV things that we're doing. The movie Birds of Prey, the TV show Birds of Prey, which, save yourself.
I'm not jumping on that grenade. You're on your own there.
The Sonic the Hedgehog movie, we've got the Lock and Key TV show, Green Eggs and Ham.
I do not like Green Eggs and Ham. I do not like it, Mark Rattledge.
BoJack Horseman, The Invisible Man, October Faction, the Harley Quinn cartoon show on DC Universe, Bloodshot, A Quiet Place 2, Chilling Adventures of the Sabrina Season 3, Mulan.
Mulan, I'm probably interested in.
Okay. So the next time you get to see David Wright here, if not Birds of Prey, then definitely Mulan.
Yeah, once things get stabilized again in my life, I'll get working on that Star Trek retrospective series. So that'll hopefully happen within the next month or two.
All right. Well,
but I'm not promising any dates.
Yeah. Well, I may be interested in that. I may not, because I don't have a lick of time.
Yeah. Exactly. We might be flying without you. But if you can make it, you're certainly welcome to join in.
Absolutely.
More details once I've worked them out. Star Trek Picard, we'll definitely be up for talking about that.
Yes, that we'll be doing a TV party for Picard on April 21st.
Yeah, I'll definitely be up for that. Haven't really made any final decisions yet. We only have two episodes, so. Is that a Top Gun Maverick? That's a definite. I will be there, and you will have me on the show.
All right, take it easy. yes, that's going to be June 30th.
Yeah, that is a big event for me.
Okay, that's very exciting. Well, make sure in big friendly letters, David Wright, Top Gun Maverick.
Absolutely, I want top billing.
Sure. All right. In the meantime, this has been Lost in Space Week. So we've got one more Lost in Space show left. That's this Thursday, the 1998 Lost in Space movie with Gary Oldman, John Hurt, and
William Hurt.
William Hurt and Matt LeBlanc. In the meantime, we'll have a review of Lordy Collection. And nothing on Friday because it's Fair Day and Birds of Prey, and I gotta go see Birds of Prey, and so nothing going on this Friday. But we got boxing this Saturday. Myself and John War will be reviewing, will be doing coverage for Kell Brook versus Mark DeLuca. We may bring you a doubleheader. It all depends on if John's available. We've got Gary Russell versus Tungstach Nyambaugh on Showtime. So. Maybe we'll bring you that, maybe we won't, but we'll definitely bring you Kell Brook versus Mark DeLuca. And then the 9th, New Japan Pro Wrestling has New Beginning in Osaka. I'm definitely going to watch it. I don't know if it's going to get reviewed or not. Depends on whether or not I can hornswoggle somebody into watching it with me. So, or rather, watching it and reviewing it with me. So we'll see what happens. So that's it. Check out what we got in the archives. We got a Witcher House of Glass. We've got The Witcher, of which 97 people were on that podcast. TV party. We've got a TV party for the Royal Rumble and Worlds Collide. And if for those of you that are interested, we did a review of Poppy. I Disagree. We did the next chapter in boxing history, focusing on Rocky Marciano. We did some boxing coverage. We did Andre versus Keeler on DAZN. And we did Ugas versus Dallas Jr. Dallas Jr. quit on the stool, the stool, at which point John War said, the boxing doesn't work that way. Get up. Which I thought was hilarious. So, more content than you can possibly listen to in a single sitting. We just keep it going. We are the content factory here on the W2M Network. Subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts. You can check us out on any podcast app. Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, Bullhorn, Overcast, whatever you're listening to, just type in W2M and you'll find us. If you happen to be listening to us on Apple Podcasts, please leave a star review of any sort, maybe a nice comment or an evil comment or a kind of mediocre comment. Just make a comment, for God's sakes.
I think I'll just give 0 stars and just write, "They let me on the show."
Perfect. 1 star, please.
Okay. You drive a hard bargain, sir.
All right, so I want to thank David Wright from the Canada office for coming on here talking about Lost in Space. I know this was a passion project for him, wanting to talk about this show. He made me do it, ladies and gentlemen. David made me do it.
Mark's lying. He's really the big fan.
So
this is all his idea.
Hey, listen, it turned out really well. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah. No, I quite enjoy these these chats.
It just causes me anxiety because I'm like, I don't have time to parent my children. I have too much TV to watch. That's what happens. My wife gets mad at me. She shakes her fist.
Hey, I waited almost a month to watch the show, and I knew it was on the schedule. So, you know, don't feel too bad about there.
Perfect. All right. For David Wright, I'm Mark Radulich. This has been TV Party Tonight on the Radulich and Broadcasting Network, part of the W2M family. Be well, be safe, and behave.